From the Sky News Centre at 6, a speedboat owner described by his own legal team as too cowardly to attend court has been jailed for 6 years for killing his date. Police are looking for Jack Shepherd, who crashed in the Thames as he tried to impress Charlotte Brown in 2015. Detective Sergeant Christopher Davis from the Met Police says an international manhunt's now underway.
We work with many agencies, both UK-based and internationally. We contact previous people that know him, family, friends, but we also have intelligence that we follow up. We're confident we will locate him.
The Met Office has upgraded weather warnings in some areas as thunderstorms replace soaring temperatures. Forecasters say they could threaten life. Laura Safe has more.
Lightning and torrential rain have been causing major travel delays and power cuts. This woman in York's abandoned her train trip.
There was this huge sort of lightning flash, really loud.
But it's high temperatures still causing problems elsewhere. Eurotunnels cancelled thousands of tickets and the heatwaves caused tragedy in Warwickshire. Police searching for a teenager who went swimming in a quarry yesterday have found a body.
Concerns were raised for a 17-year-old boy who was reported to have entered the water.
Another teenager's missing in Essex after diving from Clacton Pier.
A 6-year-old boy has died after apparently being shot with a pellet gun. Stanley Metcalf was found fatally injured in Sproatley, East Yorkshire. Prince Charles has told an inquiry into child sexual abuse that he was misled by a convicted paedophile. He's made a written statement about disgraced Bishop Peter Ball, who the prince once invited to his home. Britain's Geraint Thomas has slightly extended his lead in the Tour de France with just 2 days left. He finished second on today's 19th stage. His teammate Chris Froome's dropped to fourth overall. And thunderstorms could block your view of the longest total lunar eclipse of the 21st century. The rare event tonight will see the moon pass through Earth's darkest shadow and take on a red sheen. Well, that's the latest. I'm Simon English.
It's Bristol. It's Friday, 6 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling, helping me review this week's news as Lib Dem councillor for Brislington West, Joss Clark. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 7 o'clock news, Charlie Rowley speaks. He's the man allegedly poisoned with Novichok nerve agent in Amesbury last month. He spoke to ITV News' Rupert Evelyn about his close shave with nasty toiletries. But was what he said believable? Also, legendary US investigative journalist Seymour Hersh spoke to Afsan Razani this week on RT about his career overturning US government war myths from Vietnam to Syria. But what lessons did he learn at the start of his career that made him so sceptical about what the government was saying? And the hottest week of the year and killer fires in the Pennines and Greece. Oh, not actually killing people in the Pennines, thank God. But they're a reminder that global warming is spiralling out of control. The crazy people like Donald Trump are sabotaging us all. Or is it? The Labour leader's brother, Piers Corbyn, is one of the leading sceptics. Challenging the narrative of man-made climate change. He's what's now dubbed a climate change denier. So we hear some of his arguments this evening that the climate change agenda may be bad science. And we asked Martin Summers, if it was, what would be the point? That's in the second hour after seven. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, light cloud here in Bristol. This weekend, though, the temperatures are going to drop to around 17, 19 Celsius. Rain and possible thunderstorms over the weekend. Not a lot of sun to be seen on Saturday and Sunday. Back to the mid-20s, though, next week, with just occasional cloud through the week. Next weekend, that's the 4th and 5th of August, around 25 Celsius, back up to the sort of hot temperatures it has been. And the week after next, just more of the same. Sun and occasional cloud, but no rain. So make the most of it. If you've got anything you need watering, make sure you do it this week. Oh, it's going to be raining anyway, but at least some plants might just possibly survive. Anyway, that was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from the weatheroutlook.com. And at least hopefully you won't have to keep watering every 5 minutes this weekend. So anyway, helping us review this week's news is Lib Dem Councillor for Bridlington West, Joss Clark. Hi, Joss. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Good evening.
First of all, tell us a bit about your care and repair business. I know you're on tenterhooks at the moment. See if you're going to be able to keep going for the next actually it's not really a business, it's a charity, isn't it?
It's a charity, yes. We've been going through the bid process just recently. We should have heard at the beginning of this week whether we were successful in the contract for Bristol and also for Baines.
What do you do?
We actually work with older people over 60 and younger people with a disability, and we help them maintain their properties and stay safe in their own homes. So we also, as people's life changes, they may need a level access shower or a stairlift or something like that because of the changing disabilities, we're able to help them get those facilities into their properties and stay there safely.
Financially or just, you know, be a broker?
There's two ways of doing it, actually. There is a disabled facilities grant, which is a local government grant, which comes down from central government, and that helps to pay for, it's means tested, it helps to pay for these facilities. Or people can actually pay and have the work done, and they can have whatever they like then, really. So they've got a really good choice of contractors and styles that they might want.
Now, it's almost life and death sometimes, a stair lift. How much does something like that cost?
I couldn't tell you offhand. Maybe about £1,000 for a stair lift, level access shower, so that'd be the whole bathroom redone. That'd be about £5,000.
Crikey. It must be a bit difficult being involved in a charity like that when you're not quite sure if you're going to be able to survive, you know, if the funding is going to come through or not. Each year, I suppose, you have to go through this run the gamut.
Well, it's 5 years, actually, since we last did it. And I've been with the organisation 11 years. The organisation's been going for 30 years. We've survived so far, and I hope that we are able to continue and deliver a service. Because we are independent, I think that gives us more latitude. Quite a lot of the home improvement agencies are actually part of a housing association, and I think that puts us in a unique position and gives us more opportunities to change our offer.
What about just generally the way that disabled people are treated? I guess it is just mostly disabled people you're dealing with.
Not necessarily just disabled people. As people get older, obviously they don't necessarily want to worry about looking after their property, and they may not know who to go to. The disabled facilities grant can be quite controversial in terms of it, that people have a statutory right to an assessment and to a service if they are deemed to need it and require it. But getting that funding in place through the local authority can be quite a lengthy process. And obviously there's never enough money about.
Bridlington West, what's going on up that part of the world?
Before we move on to Bris West, can I just really just say that last week we went to the House of Lords and we won a couple of awards for We Care and Repair. One was for the Handy Person Service of the Year, which is a national award, and we also got commended for the overall service, so the whole service. So I mean, I think that's something to celebrate.
So Handy Person, how do you become Handy Person of the Year?
We have a Handy Person service that is in-house, so we employ all our handy people within We Care and Repair, and they will do things like clearing gutters for people. It's a subsidised service, so it's not full cost recovery, so it is a subsidised service, and they will do things like tap washers, all those kinds of things, those little small jobs that you just can't get round to.
So how do people get hold of We Care and Repair?
We can telephone us. Our telephone number is Bristol 954 2222.
Well, I feel like it's a very worthy advert. I just hope that you manage to keep going.
Thank you.
BridgeWest. Let's just talk about any kind of issues that are coming up there. You know, because obviously, as a councillor, actually, when people get really desperate, often, I mean, they may contact their MP, they may just gnash their teeth, but actually, they come along to you quite a lot of the time, don't they?
They do indeed. I mean, obviously, we've had the struggle which has been going on across the city with the local libraries. We seem to have had a stay of execution for 2 years to 2020. But the future of libraries is by no means certain. And it is beholden to the local communities, I think, to continue to look for other alternatives. It's very clear that's what Ash is saying.
What about the problems there's been with Universal Credit and that just generally, I mean, the move from housing benefit over to that and also with food banks?
I actually used to work in a food bank, the food bank down in St Paul's, which is it's run by the nuns and the name has escaped me. I used to work down there, volunteer down there regularly, and we used to deliver food parcels to approximately 120 people on a Sunday in an hour and a half. Over at Christmas, it'd be twice that. So there is a great need. That community is from the whole of Bristol. People were coming to us. Wasn't just from the St Paul's area.
So we're seeing an increase in this. I mean, have the Lib Dems got any thoughts about what should be done? I mean, actually, you know, many people will point the finger at the Lib Dems and say, well, when you were in bed with the Tories, you caused this austerity crisis, and so those food banks are your fault.
I think we are talking quite a long way down the line, and quite a lot of things have happened in subsequent years. Food banks are really important. There's a food bank in Whitchurch, in one of the churches up there, and they were calling for more food because they obviously have a need. So there is a need, and finances are tighter. I wouldn't necessarily take it on the chin that you can lay the blame entirely at the Lib Dems.
I mean, obviously, there's less and less money coming to local government. In fact, they're saying that maybe by 2020 we'll have only adult social care. It'll be one of the only services that local government provides. I mean, is there anything we can do about that?
In terms of children's social care?
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, education, schools have been moving away from the local authority since the Academies programme in the 80s, and that wasn't done under the Tories. Obviously, that was the brainchild of Blair, who started that, I believe. So that they have been moving away. I think there's lots of issues around the Academies programme and accountability and continuity and standards across the board. There are issues there. In terms of children's social care, there are real pressures on the finances, and local authorities are in a position where they're going to have to be much smarter.
Now, we're going to hear from Prime Minister's questions. Well, there hasn't been any Prime Minister's questions this week, Tony, I hear you say. But this is one that was from last week, which we didn't hear last week. And it's from a local, well, I say he's a local MP. I haven't heard Kerry McCarthy. I haven't heard Thangam. I haven't heard any of the local MPs, Jack Lopresti, on Prime Minister's questions for ages. But here, anyway, here is a local MP. I was just about to say he's local. He's from Stroud, and his name is David Drew. And he's talking about, and in fact, before we hear from him, Martin, let's hear a little something from you about what's been going on with special needs in schools, because I know that you've been working in schools over the last couple of years. And apparently, the whole thing of special needs is being almost forgotten about.
Well, there's enormous pressure on schools to fulfil the SATS regime, testing and so on, and that determines your funding level and all the rest of it. So, in a sense, special needs are a distraction from the main task of fact cramming and learning, rote learning, which is increasingly going on.
But surely,
on
when there is a special needs child, whatever school they're in, that school will be saying to central government, well, actually, we've got X number of special needs kids here, and we need money specifically for them.
Well, indeed there is, and there is obviously special budgets that you have to apply for kids with special needs, but they're not adequate, and that's the problem. There simply isn't adequate resources, and of course special needs is not what doesn't determine your funding formulas. Your funding formulas are determined by what your SAT scores are. So, you know, the special needs, you know, basically struggles to get the resources it requires.
I think also the local government, the local authority, has made it really difficult for parents to get assessments done on the children. They have a time frame which they haven't been meeting in terms of getting assessments done, and that the children are suffering, and that's why we've had the judicial review this week about the SEND funding, and parents are being put off actually pushing forward to getting the services that their children need, and the local authority has made it really difficult for the children to actually get in place the services.
What you're saying is the local authority's made it difficult. Actually, isn't it central government that's made it difficult by all the cuts?
Well, I understand that there is a time frame, and that officers in Bristol, the clock starts ticking when they open the email, and what they've been doing is they've been leaving an email in place unopened for a month because obviously they don't want to be doing the assessment.
Fascinating, Jules. Anyway, let's have a listen to what I think is a terrific MP personally, David Drew. He's Martin, actually, the Conservatives took Stroud, didn't they, a few years ago, and then he managed to get back in for late. In fact, if you have a look at Gloucestershire, you've got wall-to-wall blue everywhere, apart from a little bit of red in Stroud.
Well, it's the historical the history of Stroud, the Stroud Water Valley and the textile industry and so on. It makes it a bit special.
Dr. David Drew.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. In view of the fact that schools in the Stroud constituency are telling me that they're forced to use core funding to make up for the additional requirements of special educational needs, and that special schools also in the constituency are having to meet considerable rising costs, will the Prime Minister look at the national funding formula with an aim to helping those schools to make sure that they are fully inclusive and that we help those who are most vulnerable because of their special needs?
Well, can I say to the
Minister
that I have long championed the need for those children with special needs to be able to be provided for in the setting which is most appropriate for them. For some that will be in a mainstream school, for some that will be in a special needs school. We have of course changed the national funding formula to make it a fairer distribution across the country. I recognise the need, as I say, to ensure that those children with special needs are being provided for in the most appropriate setting.
One of my colleagues, Councillor Tim Kent, has been working really hard with the parents who brought a judicial review about funding for special needs in Bristol. And I take my hat off to him. He's worked tirelessly over the last few months to actually get this to court for a decision.
Martin, what Theresa May is saying is that we must find the right venue to teach special needs children.
Well, I think that's hardly controversial. I mean, some children are better off in the mainstream with special provision, and some children are better off somewhere, you know, where their needs are going to be specifically catered to. But the fact of the matter is that there isn't enough resources in the system to do all the jobs that it's being asked to do. And that's fundamental. I mean, we've all got used to the idea that there's no money, which of course is rubbish. There's plenty of money, it's just in the wrong places. And of course, what's happened with Trump in America and the increase in GNP this quarter is they've stopped trying to control the government spending. They've massively increased it. And of course, we could do the same if we wanted to. The Americans are showing the way. Whether it's going to work or not is another matter. I think it's a big bubble. But I mean, these serious questions about macroeconomic policy have been ignored for years while we've bored everybody stupid about Brexit.
Well, I mean, it's nothing to do with Brexit at all, is it?
Well, no, the
whatsoever.
Point, There's a lot of people
who are just trying to blame everything on Brexit.
Well, I'm just pointing out the natural fact the banking system is shot to pieces. Nothing has changed since 2008, and we should have been talking about that. But because it's too complicated for most people to get their heads around.
We can multitask. We can talk about more than one thing at once.
Well, we can, but most mainstream politicians simply aren't talking about the banking system. At one stage, that was all we were talking about, and everybody thinks it's all right. It's not all right. It's in a terrible state. And that's going to become increasingly obvious.
Well, we can talk about that a bit later, maybe in the second hour. Also, though, we've had I suppose it's the AGM, isn't it, of the City Council, Big Four Council meeting. We had Marvin Rees giving his great speech, the Labour Mayor. So let's have a listen to him now, because one of the things that we all get fed up with is the way that for decades and decades there's been no proper transport infrastructure put into the city. Even though we've got all these rail lines, they're not used. They spend loads of money doing feasibility studies for undergrounds and trams. And what we get is, guess what, Metro bus. Now, it's, you know, it's not going to make that much of a difference. It's great, it's wonderful, someone's doing something. But really, what they really want is the congestion charge, isn't it? They really want that. Once it gets congested enough, they can have a congestion charge and then they can start maybe building a tram or something after they've got it. Anyway, so let's have a listen now to his... it's not quite his State of the Union address that he does in the end of the year. And it's a pity that Marvin Rees is too busy, in big inverted commas, to come on this programme ever to answer questions. But here he is speaking about... transport in his, I guess it's the AGM of the City Council a couple of weeks ago.
We all know transport remains a key challenge. Many people lobby for their vested interest and can't escape the inevitability of their prejudices predetermining their proposed solutions. People movement is crucial to our city economy, our well-being, culture, to the future of jobs and education. Transport needs to pull our city together, not be used as a political weapon to drive us apart. We are focused on outcomes, connecting people to jobs and opportunity. The congestion task group has been crucial to that, and I thank those councillors, including the Leader of the Opposition. It has delivered some quick wins, and we will now continue that progress with a transport board that will bring together the expertise of city partners with the knowledge of our own transport team to face this key challenge. We are in an exciting discussion with First Bus about the next phase of growing bus use. We've had the fastest global bus use growth of bus use, now accounting for 11% of journeys to work. Smart cards, biofuel buses, park and rides, and millions invested in public transport has been delivered. And Metro Bus, a project badly managed by the former administration, is being delivered. We secured funding to provide free bus vouchers and loan bikes for people not in education, employment or training to help them get to interviews, training and work placement opportunities. We're working with local primary and secondary schools to encourage more pupils to walk to school, are providing match funding for businesses to help them invest in sustainable travel facilities and supported cycling initiatives across the city. We've secured funding to support taxi drivers transition away from diesel engines. However, the key challenge remains making a systematic change to the way people travel in, to and around Bristol. I do not support the flawed belief that modal shift will occur simply by making it harder to travel around the city or that car drivers are the enemy. And the planned consultation on the Bristol Transport Plan will shape a new policy that changes that. We will not achieve modal shift or accelerate a move away from private cars without an affordable, sustainable alternative. And the mass transit system remains a key ambition for me and my team. We will announce more progress on that shortly.
So that's the Bristol's Labour Mayor, Marvin Rees, there talking about transport. A bit of a clunky speech, though, Joss, I think. You know, it's kind of almost like sort of sixth form essay writing rather than, you know, sort of great speech. I don't know if he writes his own speeches. But anyway, the point really here being that a lot of it is indecipherable almost. I mean, he's talking about modal shifts, cars being the enemy. I mean, what did you make of it?
I was shaking my head in despair, really. The Metro bus has not been a great success thus far and has been a really controversial scheme, and I really hope that we get it on track and it starts delivering very soon. It's actually not going to make any difference to my life in Brislington. It's too far away from me to for me ever to really use it. What we need to do as an authority, as a region, is grasp the nettle and actually deliver more and better buses across the whole area. It's not just about the Metro bus.
But actually, the first are taking services away. Actually, I think it's Wessex buses.
Wessex,
we
51.
Heard last week from Gary Hopkins, yeah, bus services are being reduced, even though, as Marvin's saying there, the demand is going up and up.
Well, there you go. It's about lots of it. It's about subsidies, clearly. I mean, this is the excuse that it appears to be coming out when I asked questions to the mayor about the arena, and when we were going to hear about the arena, and obviously people in Brislington, not obviously, but generally people in Brislington are really keen to have an arena close because it's going to make a massive difference to us. It'll be a really positive thing in my area. And one of the things that Marvin cited was, oh, well, people won't want an arena in near Brislington because of extra traffic. Well, if you have a really good bus service on and off the site, then we wouldn't have to have loads of extra cars in the area.
Yeah, that A4 at Brislington is notorious.
It's dreadful.
Yeah, is there anything going to happen about that? Do you know any thoughts about making those cars move?
Right. I live just by the A4, so I know it really well. The spatial strategy, there's a plan to move the park and ride from Brislington down to Hicks Gate. So down towards the dual carriageway.
Further out.
Yeah, much further out. It would actually, the park and ride would go into South Gloucestershire, but only just. And what would happen there is you'd have a hub, and you'd have buses going back down the A4 towards Bath, around the dual carriageway, Ring Road. So you'd have many more opportunities to get out of your car and get onto a bus further out of Bristol.
But the main problem is that junction with the Ring Road. That seems to be what holds everything up. I mean, I go down there from time to time, try and avoid it if I can. But, you know, that seems to be a total bottleneck. Is anything going to happen with that?
What they're going to try and do is, as I say, is deliver a better bus service to try and encourage people out. Yeah. But they are talking about having a new road in Brislington from Tesco's in Callington Road across along the old railway line to Sainsbury's, which will actually link up with the Spine Road. Mm. Well, all you're going to do is increase the traffic because you're putting another road in.
I think they need a tunnel. I think that's what they need there, tunnel.
It's just desperation, really.
We haven't got the money for that. Oh, God. Anyway, I mean, it's only the A4. Who cares? You know, the main road between Bath and Bristol.
I do care. I really care because it goes through my ward.
Yeah, I do too. I mean, it just seems that this is like the last thing on the list. Anyway, back to the full council meeting. Replying to Marvin was, I guess he's the leader of the opposition. I am actually just guessing here. Mark Weston, the leader of the Conservative group, talking about transport in reply to Marvin.
And then you come to transport. Well, I'm sorry, transport's going to be critical, but I heard nothing in the Mayor's speech today on rail. We talked about buses, they're part of the solution. Where was the ambition on rail? You want to do an underground? We were spending $4.5 million on a feasibility study for an underground. We don't have the $4.5 billion it will require to pay for it, but, you know, we'll spend the $4.5 million on the study. Well, fantastic. That's a station. We should be looking at Metro West Phase 3, Metro West Phase 4. We should be on Metrobus Phase 4, Metrobus Phase 5. We should be looking at all of this, and that was not mentioned today. I'm afraid I see a divided city. I see you have to work with them. You have to ask. This is how it works. Are you working with them on it? We have to work together. And I see a divided city, I see a divided chamber, and I, for one, do not recognise what the Mayor has said. We all work with him where we can, but it's increasingly obvious to us that the Mayor has very little interest in working with anyone of any party that disagrees with him remotely. I hope your Cabinet members are sitting comfortably. We have bets on who's the next out. Thank you, my Lord Mayor.
Anyway, so that was Mark Weston. I'm afraid, actually, Mark did get more applause than that, but the webcast, they're very cheeky at the City Council. When Marvin finishes his speech, they leave the full applause, which lasts for, I don't know, whatever, 10 seconds or so. I can see it when I'm editing it on my timeline. So, but that when any of the opposition people finish their speech, like Mark did then, they just completely cut all of the applause, so you can't hear it. Anyway, Martin, what do you make of what Mark's saying there, effectively, that any of the really big projects and projects which will really make a difference, including basic stuff like rail, Marvin doesn't even mention it.
Well, I mean, the fact is that transport policy has been made a complete mess of in this country for 30 or 40 years, and Bristol City Council is part of that mess. We should never have privatised the bus services
but
in
Marvin
this country.
Rees doesn't need to be part of the mess, does he? Surely.
Well, no, what he's doing there, Tony, is he's basically giving boilerplate. We'd like things to be better, wouldn't we all?
Okay,
but
so
the fact
spending,
is the resources
spending,
required to make it better are not being made available
spending,
by the government or anybody else.
£4.5 million on a feasibility study for his underground. Mark's pointing out, there you go, that's actually, you can actually open a new line and build a station for that.
Well, that's a fair point, if you like, but if it turns into that, if there is an underground in the long run, that will be proved wrong, wouldn't it? I think the problem is there simply isn't the resources. I mean, I've heard him talking about getting funding for this underground from China and so on. That's because central government simply doesn't make the resources available that it ought to make available
to have an integrated transport policy.
The City
of London, couldn't they make some resources?
Well, I mean, the City of London, of course, they didn't completely privatise the bus services because they couldn't. It would have been chaotic. As it has been elsewhere, and therefore they've allowed the franchising system that Gary Hopkins was talking about last week to operate in London. Now, obviously, we should have a similar system
but
in Bristol, but the fact of the matter is we shouldn't have privatised the railways
well,
or the buses
that.
In the first
it's easy
place.
To say it's happened. Some of the biggest money ever has been made on railways, when big banks finance railways, when they finance public transport projects, when they finance housing too, it's guaranteed money back. So why don't they do it?
They don't do it because it's not guaranteed money back in the timescale that they're interested in, otherwise the private sector would have developed all this years ago.
Timescale, okay.
Yes, well, of course.
The penny's finally dropped.
Yes, when people are investing to make money, they want the money back, Tony, unless it's done by the government, which of course is what should happen.
What you're saying is you want it
should
it back,
be done by the government, like in Russia. The Russian railways are still owned by Russia.
They want it back straight away. Okay, fair enough. Josh, can you make any sense of this for us?
I don't know whether I want to get between you at the moment.
Okay, well, fair enough. You know, Martin's going up on his high horse about this, but I mean, I think
but when Gary last week was pointing about having a franchising system, that's a doable do given the circumstances we're in. But I'm making a wider point, which is we've done the wrong things in this country for 30 years. We shouldn't have privatised the railways,
and
in that case, we should reverse it.
Good.
And of course, that's what Labour Party grassroots are saying. Why didn't we reverse it when we were 13 years in power? Very good question.
Well, one of the problems at the moment, and particularly, I mean, you mentioned the arena, is that it's been very difficult to actually get any information from Marvin Rees about what he's planning. The plan seems to be not to build the arena in Bristol, but to build it out in Filton. Now, what do you make of that decision? Because I noticed that one of the Labour councillors, Fabian Breckles, was tweeting, and he seems to have kind of completely disappeared off the face of the earth since he did it, that maybe Marvin should be deselected if he moves, or he tries to move the arena to Filton, because it's a Bristol project. It needs to be in Bristol.
All the evidence over the last few weeks has been that the mayor is minded to put the arena in Filton.
Because it's cheaper.
All the evidence is that local people would like the arena in the Temple Meads. The councillors, I would say, are fairly united in wanting it in Temple Meads. I certainly think it would be a positive thing for Temple Meads along with the university.
Well, I don't want to be too cynical, but has maybe the mayor promised that bit of land at Temple Meads to somebody else, maybe to the university or to other developers?
I think that he has started making a very strong case of why we shouldn't have the arena at Temple Meads, because he's saying that you can generate more employment, more money by doing other things with the site.
And do you buy that?
No.
Anyway, let's hear now from Anthony Negus. He's the leader of your party, the Lib Dems, Jos Clark. You're from Brissington West. And see what he had to say at this City Council, the last full council meeting, in reply to Marvin's speech, Anthony is particularly annoyed about the secrecy.
We are concerned about this double-handed dealing. It's not straightforward. Things are kept from elected councillors. We are not given the information we need to help play a meaningful role in making decisions to benefit this whole city. I certainly don't like, and Councillor Comrie referred to it, I certainly would much rather work with people in this chamber. And many of you will know that because you've worked alongside us. You know what we're capable of. You know what we're trying to achieve here. Some of you have actually applauded us for that, and thank you. That's where we would naturally come from. But in fact, all the time, we are scratching away trying to get information, the information which frankly should be available if we're going to be a part of this decision-making process. And we're grown-ups. We need to be able to help and assure our electorate that things are being done in the way that we can believe in. And we can't possibly do that without the information that's being withheld from us.
I agree with Anthony's sentiments that the mayor is obviously letting the city have a conversation, but actually we're not being party to the decision making. It feels like it's a done deal. It feels like when he went to Malaysia, the decisions were made then, and all he's doing is he's just hanging on and making a stronger case. But I'm really hoping that at the cabinet in September that we have a definitive announcement one way or the other.
These are really important decisions for the future of the city, but it seems as if they're being made behind the scenes and quite often with commercial contractors, and the people who are going to make money out of these various schemes are, I wouldn't say calling the shots, but they seem to have the ear of the mayor.
One of the things that concerns me about this whole process, along with a number of other things that are happening in the city, is the mayoral system feels quite undemocratic in that we have 70 councillors and the mayor can basically do whatever they want to do, whether the council is behind them or not. And I think that is to the detriment of democracy.
So you're kind of treading water?
Yeah.
Anyway, here, Joss, is yourself, and you spoke
Looking
at this meeting too.
To the year ahead, the work programme will allow members to evaluate the work of the council and enable challenge and scrutinise the robustness of the council and its processes. I wish the new chair, Councillor Mead, the best wishes, and thank you, Lord Mayor.
Well, that was actually just the tail end of your, because they cut off a bit of the beginning of your applause. But anyway, Joss, the reason I played that is because I'm a little bit worried. In fact, I'm very worried that now the Labour group is going to be in charge of audit. You used to be chair, I think, didn't you?
I was indeed, yes. I share your concerns about that. I think that audit, I would say this, wouldn't I? Audit is a really important commission. I thoroughly enjoyed being on audit. I thought it was absolutely fascinating.
Well, there's very few people that would say that, you know. What did you enjoy about it? How can you enjoy looking at loads of sheets of figures?
It's because it's really important, and actually on audit you can make a difference, and I think that's really important. We had an opportunity to scrutinise the internal, external audit, a whole range of issues, but having Labour in positions such as chair means that they are scrutinising themselves, and I think that is actually not really good for democracy, because if there are issues that the leading party don't want people to find out about, it's a really good way to put a chair in, isn't it?
Martin, this is a similar sort of thing goes on at Westminster as well, where all the main committees are generally, I mean, this is an accepted norm, that they're chaired by opposition party groups, either SNP, Lib Dem or Labour at Westminster. So it seems that we're changing things around here so that the various types of scrutiny of what the City Council are up to are actually going to be chaired in future by Labour people.
Well, I can't say that I'm an expert on any of this. What I would say is, what do they do in other major cities? I mean, because in actual fact, of course, we did have an all-party administration here, but that's very unusual, and it was ended.
How can one party scrutinise itself?
What do they do in other cities?
What happened was when we had the debate and all the constitution came to full council, the Labour administration changed the formula by which chairs were actually divvied out, which it favoured the largest party. And so the opposition groups lost the opportunity to sit on chairs. Now, there's a couple of reasons for that. One is money, and secondly is it was giving the leading group more power.
Money? In what way, money?
Because you get a special responsibility allowance for being a chair of a commission.
Oh, it's like a reward to people in your own party?
Yes.
For being obedient?
Yes.
Crikey, that's interesting. Fascinating stuff. Anyway, that's just definitely not a very good way to take the city, Marvin Rees, if you're interested in being in any way democratic. Anyway, I haven't heard this on other media, and he says, moving swiftly to a similar sort of topic, is John Cleese. And we should have really had him on last week, but here he is talking on Newsnight about why he's leaving Britain. And I just thought it was rather smart of him to choose Newsnight's Emily Maitlis to make some of these very important points about how awful the British media is.
The European Union, every year, asks 1,000 people in each of 33 different countries what their trust level is in the printed media in those countries. Mm. And they publish a report. Now, this is this year's that's just come out. And the country that has the largest trust are the Netherlands. Mm. And then after that, we've got Finland, Denmark, Sweden, Austria, and so forth. And then in the middle here, we've got Lithuania, Croatia, Turkey. Mm. And then right down the bottom, could I ask you just to read the last two or three countries? Malta.
Yeah, we get it. Okay. So you've got United Kingdom is the lowest one. Can I just...
Lowest out of 33.
Yes, but look, you just missed out. One of the most trusted written press countries is Albania, which comes in second. Mm-hmm. So perhaps there is a correlation between the kind of press which is robust, which creates a certain level of curiosity and cynicism.
Yes. No, it's the lying and the triviality that I object to. This is not just this year, Emily. This is the same last year. We were 33rd out of 33. It was the same the year before. And the year before that. So for 4 years, we've had the least trusted press in Europe.
But least trusted does not necessarily mean not true. A certain level of...
No, this is what I feel about Brexit. One of the most depressing things about this country was the standard of debate about Brexit. It was awful. There were dreadful lies on the right about all the money that would come into the National Health Service if we went. And there was the usual thing, just scare tactics from Cameron and Osborne, you know, oh, it'll be a disaster. That was the level of the debate. Nobody said, it's very complicated. There's a guy called Philip Tetlock, who's a university professor at the University of Philadelphia, who's done research on this. And he, over a period of about 20 years, he studied pundits in America and Canada, 284 of them, and he asked them a number of questions. Altogether, they made 82,000 predictions about what would happen in 5 years and 10 years. Let me finish, because I'm coming to the key point. Come on, mate, this. Put yourself together. The point that he made was that they were hopeless at forecasting. He said it was hardly better than chance, and that the pundits were no better than a reader of the New York Times.
Okay?
So what I'm saying is very few people have any idea what's actually going to happen. It's much harder to forecast the future than we think.
Yeah.
So why is everyone so passionate when they can't possibly know what the outcome is?
Great question. The sort of great question you hardly ever hear on the BBC. Thank you very much, John Cleese. But I'm also joined by former Sunday Times journalist and writer, Kevin Carhill. Kevin, what do you make of the statement by John Cleese there? He's saying it's the lies and the trivia that he's fed up with. What's your assessment of
the lies,
media?
Trivia and pure propaganda? The whole Brexit debate almost both sides, was a propaganda exercise. People don't trust propaganda, it's lies. And the print media, with perhaps the exception of The Guardian, have disgraced themselves. And look at The Express. Its front page is often a straight lie. And most people know that, so they throw it in the bin.
Well,
wrap
this,
the fish.
Prosecution of the Vote Leave campaign may be happening as well. The only thing was an interesting thing about that was that apparently twice as much money was spent on the Remain campaign than on the Leave campaign. So it clearly didn't influence the result. And also the government had its own campaign, which was a Remain campaign.
Yeah, no, it didn't. It's one of the things. You got one of the lead Brexiteers here in Bristol, Mr. Aaron Banks, and Channel 4 are really showing what a peculiar person. He put in 9 million quid, the biggest donation of all, based on the fact he was a diamond mining billionaire. Well, Channel 4 showed a picture two nights ago of the five diamonds. That is all that one of his mines has found. So the people who supported him and didn't question him, particularly the media, about where the money was coming from, disgraced themselves.
Martin?
Well, I think there's still obviously a lot of disagreement going on about what happened in the referendum campaign. Money was channeled through the DUP to the Leave campaign, and of course it wasn't, because they've got different rules in Northern Ireland about what they have to say about where the money came from. They've been very cagey about where it actually came from. But I think both sides, I mean, in a referendum campaign, both sides have got lots of dirty money flushing around, and that's what happens in elections as well. Dirty money's all over the place.
Tiny chance. There's still a chance to see probably the best programme of all. It started with the DUP. It's still on iPlayer for another 9 days. BBC Spotlight Northern Ireland. Brexit, dark money and the DUP.
OK, I'll tell you what. I'll put a link up to it on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Do you think there should be a second referendum, Joss?
Yeah, the trouble with the referendum is... is going to be a binary. Is it in that was a problem with the referendum we've had previously, the last one and ones before that. A binary yes no response. It's a much more nuanced than that, and I think that that's where a lot of the problems were and are. That people are actually, there's much more information. It's much more complicated than anybody could have ever imagined, and to say in out was just insufficient. We should never have gone there.
Okay, on to a national story, which is local too. Letters show friendship, this is in the Times today, between Prince Charles and sex abuse Bishop Peter Ball. This has been quite well covered in the regional, well, the regional TV here, Points West, etc. The Prince of Wales complained of the monstrous wrongs done to a disgraced sex offender bishop. Private letters obtained by a public inquiry suggest extracts from a 20-year correspondence between Prince Charles and Bishop Peter Ball were read today at the Independent Inquiry into Child Sexual Abuse on the last day of hearings into the case. I wish I could do more, the Prince of Wales wrote to Ball in February 1995. I feel so desperately strongly about the monstrous wrongs that have been done to you and the way you have been treated. The letter was written 2 years after Ball admitted gross indecency against a 17-year-old novice monk and accepted a police caution when he was Bishop of Gloucester. Martin.
Well, I mean, this is part of this ongoing VI paedophile scandal.
It's not the first time, is it? Because Prince Charles was very friendly with Jimmy Savile, too.
Indeed, and Timmy Savile used to be one of his events organisers, I understand.
Now, Charles would say, oh, well, you know, I've been duped by this guy.
Well, the fact is that the inquiry into all of this has been eviscerated. They've taken out Northern Ireland, so they're not going to look at Kinkora, where everybody in Northern Ireland knows that Kinkora was used by MI5 as a honey trap. People had sex with underage boys and were then blackmailed by MI5. They're not even looking into that, because it's not part of the British jurisdiction, apparently, which is pretty much made Sinn Féin's case for them. But I mean, the underlying all of this is the use by the intelligence services of child sex abuse as a tool of blackmail. That's why all these top people have been doing it.
But isn't
not
it
just
also,
because they've got nasty
Martin, isn't
liberty.
It also the mob who've been basically the mafia and using these children's homes, particularly as we saw up in Rotherham, state children's homes for this kind of thing?
The kind of children who end up in these homes are terribly vulnerable, and there's obviously an ongoing problem with them being abused. But the VIP file scandal, the high level people, the people at the top of like Heyman, who is the deputy director of MI6, who left child pornography on the bus. It was found by the police and it traced back to him. There's a culture of child pornography and using child abuse as a means of blackmail in the secret services
Kevin,
in this country.
Anyway, for someone who's been around a while, a bit long in the tooth, and this must have come across your desk over the years, what do you make of this latest thing with Prince Charles?
Well, I was talking to the former MP John Hannam last week, and one of the things I found, I was down in the National Archives. It was during the was it the head of Bernardo's? Somebody high up in the system had said they found nothing. You know, they'd gone through all the records. He and a QC had gone down.
Oh, and that's right. This is the files.
Yeah.
Files that all disappeared.
Yeah, well, we found them. You know, they were, because they weren't on the computer system, but they were all in files, in shelves. We found 127 children's homes with secret reports closed for 100 years. There were 127, and that was just the London area.
So you found the files, but they were closed, and you couldn't look at them?
We couldn't look at them, no. They were closed for 100
years. Sounds like David Kelly, doesn't it? The whole David Kelly cover-up.
Yeah. The culture of, you know, vicious secrecy here is terrible.
Joss, what do you make of this? Because, I mean, we heard last week from one of the correspondents, I think he was a policeman, I can't remember. No, hang on. He was running an aid to child sex abuse victims up in Scotland. And he was saying that you this awful situation that sometimes women go to the police about abuse either of themselves or the children, and then they find their own children taken away from them.
I am actually a qualified social worker, and I used to work in children and families, and I actually worked in residential children's homes in Somerset, and I have to say that I've never came across any sexual abuse by staff or external perpetrators, to my knowledge. These are really vulnerable children, and I think maybe on occasions there were children who were getting involved with pimps and things like that. But that was very, very difficult to hold and control them. But it's a really difficult, and I really hope, that, hand on heart, that it's not happening today. But maybe somewhere it may be.
What do you make of Prince Charles and his letter to this inquiry? It might have been better, you know, some would say, just to not say anything about it.
I feel deeply saddened, actually. I feel deeply saddened that people within the church knew and protected this individual. Our institutions should not be doing that.
Well, I mean, Prince Charles was set to become the head of the church, you know, the whole of the Church of England. So, you know, he doesn't seem to be the right sort of person to be in charge of this kind of thing if he's going to go to a bishop who has already admitted gross indecency against a 17-year-old and say, oh, I want to see if I can help you, you know, because you're being wronged, even though you've accepted a police caution, admitted your guilt. I'm still here to help you if you need me.
But we have people within the church who are obviously protecting him as well, which makes it, it's just so it becomes endemic, doesn't it?
Anyway, some good news this week from the government, the public sector pay award for hospital and school workers. And Jeremy Corbyn mentioned this at his big speech. Well, I say big, it was hardly covered at all, but it was interesting, so other than to have a go at him for saying that for cheap imported goods were not a good thing, because he was having a go at foreign workers. And it is about the public sector to pay cap, which has been lifted, and this is what Mr. Corbyn had to say about it.
On the public sector pay cap, the government has said it's going to lift the pay cap. The reality is that by lifting the pay cap, there's going to be an increase that is below the rate of inflation, and it's going to be about 0.8% below it. And the unions are right that 5% is what is needed for it. We support that. But it's also important to understand that there's no increase in funding to the public sector for this. So by increasing the pay levels, albeit by less than the rate of inflation, that can only be paid for by cuts within the public services. And so if it's local authorities or anybody else, they're going to have to pay for it by either removing their balances, which they shouldn't be doing, or by cutting services further. And so there has to be an increase in the amount of money paid into the public service in order to increase the pay. How would that be paid for? By the taxation process that we would have, by economic growth, and by increase in corporate levels of taxation.
Well, I suppose it's a perfect example of spin, Martin Summers, isn't it, where you say it's a 5% increase, but actually, as Jeremy Corbyn's pointed out, it's actually nearly a 1% decrease because it's not keeping up with inflation.
Well, I mean, of course, and previous to that, there was no increase at all for years. So there's plenty of scope for people to catch up or need to catch up. I mean, ultimately, it comes back to your macroeconomic policy, and we've still got an austerity policy, even though it's nearly crashed the economy. We lost our AAA credit rating when the Tories and the Liberals were in coalition, and they lost the country's AAA credit rating. If a Labour government had done that, the Tory press would have gone bonkers.
What do you make of Corbyn's Build It in Britain campaign?
Well, I think what he's talking about is, let's have, there's been a lot of talk about having an industrial policy. We gave up having an industrial policy in this country 30 years ago when Thatcher came in. And of course, other countries like Norway have never given up having an industrial policy. They've always had an industrial policy. Sensible countries have got one. We are now talking about having one, but of course, we still haven't got one.
We've been told that it's good, even advanced for our country, to manufacture less and less and rely instead on cheap labour abroad to produce imports while we focus on the City of London and the financial sector. A lack of support for manufacturing industry is sucking the dynamism out of our economy. We in the Labour Party are committed to turning things round. That's why we'll build things here again that for too long have been built abroad, because we have failed to invest. We can get rid of this magical thinking of the free market that has led to a minority becoming extremely rich at the expense of everybody else. And we will replace it with a new economy transformed so that it can be for and by the many, not the few. And we'll forge a new relationship between workers, manufacturers and local communities and a government to end the unregulated bankers' rip-off, which has dehumanised our values and our economy while allowing a few to profit at the expense of the many. Labour will reprogram our economy so it works for the people of this country and not against them. And we'll build this economy, this future fair for all, right here in Britain, in every part of the country. Thank you for coming today.
Jeremy Corbyn there. Martin, is this some sort of an industrial policy? I noticed actually trying to look up this Build It in Britain campaign. Most of the press articles seem to be criticising Jeremy Corbyn for having a pop at cheap foreign labour.
Well, I mean, they're having a go at Jeremy Corbyn because it's just like having a go at Jeremy Corbyn. All he's saying there is what ought to be common sense. Whether it can be delivered is another matter in a globalised world with a potential crash on the horizon and all the rest of it, which, of course, we're not allowed to talk about, even though it's the most important thing that's out there to consider. But, of course, I mean, it's been a truism for years that this policy of not having an industrial policy has deindustrialised Britain. And, of course, the property price bubbles in the south east of Britain generally lead to raises in interest rates, which then crushes industry north of the Wash, and it's been going on for a very long time, as intensified in the Thatcher era, and that's why we deindustrialised. And of course, you shouldn't deindustrialise.
Joss, I mean, Bristlington used to be, I think they used to make buses and things up, and trucks, lorries up at Bristlington.
Do we need?
I don't know if you remember those days. It must have been probably the 1970s or 80s that closed down.
But yeah, we had on the A4 corridor. corridor, there was quite a lot of manufacturing, wasn't there? There was the brake linings they were making.
So Jeremy Corbyn's going to bring it back?
Well, Brexit's going to bring a new era of many things, I'm sure.
Brexit, Jeremy Corbyn will bring it back and Brexit will stop him. Anyway, thanks. Time now for the Murdoch News at 7. Thanks to our guests, Lib Dem Councillor for Islington West, Joss Clark. Join us after the news as we take a global look around
BCFM
the international
picture. On 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.